Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Ayo, Dr. Santosh here, pediatric infectious disease and researcher, coming to you live from the Midwest. I'm on spring break with my kids. And
spring break!
Spring break! We decided to spring break with our family in Iowa. It is snowing so hard outright.
Spring break!
Spring break!
All that corn!
Yeah. There's no corn right now. It's wintertime.
I was doing some completely unrelated historical research, and I was reading about the history of artificial sweeteners like Sweet'n'Low.
Oh, yes. Saccharin and aspartame, that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Do you know that pretty much every single artificial sweetener that exists was discovered by accident and effectively somebody licking their fingers?
So I knew that about, I believe that was saccharin, because saccharin is the amino acid, or aspartame? I can't remember. No, aspartame is the amino acid. And it was, and essentially people were engineering amino acids for, I can't remember the purpose.
Let me give you a brief history of artificial sweeteners before we get to our actual episode today.
Oh, sure. I know it does tangentially have to do with our episodes, but please do. Yeah.
So saccharin, 1879, two Johns Hopkins University students came into existence when one of them tasted a sweet compound on his hand while developing coal tar derivatives. Definitely something you want to lick. Saccharin, 200 to 700 times sweeter than sucrose, and became popular due to a sugar shortage following World War One. Wow. Wait, that three times fast.
Yeah.
Saccharin, sugar shortage.
Saccharin, sugar shortage, sugar shortage, sugar shortage. Yeah, yeah.
Saccharin, okay. Sweeter than sucrose, sugar shortage. Okay. Next up, 1937, we got cyclamate when Michael Cepeda also tasted something sweet during his smoke break while working on antipyretic medications. So he's trying to make fever drugs, licked off his hand. He's like, hey, this is sweet. Also, also cancer-causing, but, you know, we're going to blaze past that.
There are so many safety...
No. Let's move on. We don't have the time for those sort of things.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
Aspartame.
Uh-huh.
low calorie sweetener again, 200 times sweeter. James Schlatter, all of these guys have sugar based names. James Schlatter developing a anti-ulcer drug in 1965, also licked something sweet off his finger.
Okay.
Then we get to ones I haven't even heard of, Ace Sulfame K or Ace K. The sweetener was discovered when, drumroll please, a scientist unintentionally tasted a sweet compound while licking his finger.
What? Stop. Just stop.
Okay. All right. How about sucralose? Discovered 1976 when researchers bonded sucrose and chlorine molecules, and one of the researchers, this is my favorite, misheard the direction and accidentally tasted the compound instead of testing the compound.
What? How? How do you make that? Okay, fine.
Every artificial sweetener we have ever had, based on something's on my finger, I should lick it.
There is a weird romanticized nostalgia that I do think about sometimes when it comes to these.
After we had all these scientists licking their fingers to provide us with sugar substitutes.
Sure.
Let's talk very, very briefly about Sweet and Low itself. And when I say briefly, it was introduced by the guy who invented the single serving sugar packet, but didn't patent it. So instead, he started making artificial sweeteners. It's pink because that's going to draw your attention to it in the sugar bowl. So you take their brand over another.
Oh, and yes.
You may not realize this, but it has a little musical note on the side of the package. And in case you've ever wondered what that is for, it is because the name of the company, Sweet and Low, was based off an 1863 song called Sweet and Low, and that was based on an Alfred Lord Tennyson poem titled The Princess Sweet and Low, which has nothing to do with sugar. Okay. All of which has nothing to do with our episode today, aside from the fact that we are going to be talking about things that can affect sweet and things that you'd like to keep low. And if I'm doing this much of a delayed intro, you know what that means, Santosh. It is an alternate week.
Yes.
Something we haven't had for a while. And Woo. What happens during alternate weeks? We get to do everybody's favorite segment, Kermit Arms in the Air. It's time for another Journal Club. Yay! Woo. So let's start with a low story, something that's going to make you feel a little low, and then something we'd like to be lower.
Okay.
Microplastics. Coming up a lot. On the news lately. They are everywhere. Can't get away from them. We used to say we were 30 or 50 or some percentage water, and now that part of that percentage is becoming plastic-based. In fact, microplastics have been found in almost every organ, blood, organs, tissues. In fact, a study from 2021 found microplastics in the blood of about 80% of the people tested.
Oh dear. Yeah, I'm not surprised. The question then at this point is going to be, what does it matter? What is it actually doing to us? Because it's a fear-inducing statement. But as far as we know, these materials are biologically inert.
So we're all Barbie girls in a Barbie world. Life in plastic. Let's find out what it's doing to us.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm just Ken, but
So we've got all these circulating microplastics in our system, and even taking all the best steps, there's not a ton you can do to avoid it. So researchers first recruited people undergoing surgery to treat their carotid artery disease. And that's a condition where plaques, which traditionally have been made up of fatty substances like cholesterol or calcium, deposit and narrow the arteries that deliver blood, in the case of the carotids, to the brain, but just end up kind of clogging up your arteries. So we used to say, avoid greasy foods, fatty foods. We'd put you on cholesterol blockers. We can't really put you on plastic blockers. So how much are plastics contributing to these plaques that can cause heart disease and stroke?
Oh, this is very interesting. So we do understand the interaction between cholesterol, the excess accumulation of cholesterol into the basically the walls of your arteries to create a clot or a clog in, you know, major arteries that supply your heart, your brain, and other organs. We also do know, Josh, that there is a large component of inflammation that goes with that. So there are people who have stable cholesterol plaques where, you know, the artery will be narrow, but they're not in danger of that clot actually rupturing and forming a full clot and closing off the artery and causing a heart attack or a stroke. But there are those who have unstable disease. And a lot of this is because that area becomes inflamed. And we actually learned, you know, in the last decade or so that those statins, the cholesterol blockers, actually, as much as they lower your cholesterol, they also block inflammation. So if plastics are also irritants, or if they interact with the cholesterol in some way to make the plaques unstable, this would definitely be a cause for concern.
Well, first, we want to know how much these plaques are made up of plastics. There's going to be a lot of alliteration and tongue twisters in this episode. I'm just warning you ahead of time.
Do you mean one of your favorite episodes of all time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Peter Piper picked a peck of microplastics.
Oh, no. Oh, my heart. Yeah. Okay.
These plaque-promoting microplastics, how many did he pick? So these plaques from the carotid artery were removed during surgery and then analyzed for their microplastic and nanoplastic, abbreviated MNP, no O, just MNP, content. Out of the 257 patients studied, 150 of them had plaques containing polyethylene, a material that's often used to make plastic bags and bottles. And the overall study looked at 304 patients, of which 257 completed the study. 150 of them had this polyethylene in the carotid artery plaque. 31 also had polyvinyl chloride, you may know by the name PVCs. Mm-hmm. And looking at patients who had these MNPs detected, they ended up having a higher risk of myocardial infarction, meaning heart attack, stroke, or death from any cause within 34 months of follow-up than those who you did not detect plastics. So plastic does actually raise the danger of a cardiovascular event. And as we said, the presence of MNPs in plaque is pretty significant itself to see that it's making up a detectable amount of these plaques. So they followed up the patients not just for a week or two, but for 3 years. And patients who had these plaques with MNP had a 2-time greater risk of stroke or death from any cause than those who did not have plastic fragments.
Yeah, so just to let everybody know where these patients were coming from, you can have carotid artery stenosis, meaning that there's narrowing of that blood vessel, without ever having had a heart attack or a stroke before. But these lesions are detected because the patient is having, you know, transient symptoms of some kind. And one of the places that a doctor is going to look for is in the neck, to look for the blood supply from the heart to the brain. And in a select group of people, you're going to find carotid artery stenosis without actual strokes going on. And I know it sounds really, really scary, but you can open up the carotids and you can actually lift out those plaques and then close it back up and everything is fine. So all of these folks were at some degree at risk for stroke or heart attack because they were having artery stenosis. But the interesting thing is exactly what you said, Josh, is not all of them will go on to have, true ischemic events, meaning that where the blood supply is actually cut off to either the brain or the heart. Now, they had to do exclusions here. So if the person already had heart failure, valve defects, if they were cancer patients who had stenosis for other reasons or other causes of high blood pressure other than primary blood pressure elevation, then they were excluded. And the patients were, of course, adults and not pediatric. But yeah, it was a one-time snapshot at the amount of microplastics in the plaque, because they couldn't go back in and get repeated samples over that post-surgical observational period. So we don't know what happened before, or we don't know what happened after these plaques were lifted out, but we could just correlate with this snapshot with what would happen over the next 3 years.
So a summary is microplastics, keep them low. They can cause a risk of stroke.
Yeah.
No, wait, I can do better than that, because you mentioned yes. Pediatrics.
Yes.
Microplastics, keep them low. Risk of stroke in embryos. So
what?
Because another study suggests microplastics have been found in both the placenta and breast milk, and they
That's
can
true.
Negatively impact a body weight and organ development of the fetus. Now, the reason for that is they act as endocrine disruptors. So you mentioned they're inert materials. Having the microplastics itself is not inherently toxic to a developing fetus, but it prevents and can bind to other endocrine signaling, which can cause long-term effects on health. It can lead to abnormal umbilical artery blood flow through the creation of some of these plaques. And if you're getting less blood from the umbilical artery, that can slow down the development of the growing fetus.
There was data collected on one of the more commonly talked about plastics, which is BPA or bisphenol A. And what that would do to, same kind of a thing, a developing child during pregnancy. And there were correlations made with, for instance, rates of developmental disorders, global developmental disorders, such as autism. But it wasn't so clear that, the large societies and foundation could make a true guideline or a statement on them. So we know that these effects are likely going on. We just don't know the full extent.
Right. And again, it's not necessarily raising the risk for any particular condition, as pretty much every time people start testing the placenta, they detect microplastics.
Yeah,
everywhere on earth, in every single placenta, and people are still being born. So this is not to sound the alarm in terms of, is your baby at risk? Like, yeah, well, we all are, but
yes,
it's not for any particular individual condition.
That's absolutely true. It is not fair to, go ahead and point out that, like, oh my God, and then, run around like our hair is on fire. I wish we did have better control patients where we could say, oh, let's take a look at a population of folks who are not exposed to microplastics. And that population is not available on Earth, or if you're talking about a population that's so isolated away from plastics and such that, they're not going to be exposed, they have a ton of other differences from us in the West and in, city living type of society, because they're going to be things like hunter-gatherers in the depths of jungles or faraway islands and things like that. So they're not at all equivalent to folks who would be running the study.
In scientific terms, we're out of control.
Yes.
Because we don't have a control group.
There you go. Wahaha.
So let's, now that we've brought you low.
Yes.
Let's talk about something sweet. See how we're tying this all to the arbitrarily specifically chosen title of the episode.
I love it. Yeah. Do it.
How would you feel, Santosh, if you were perhaps diabetic and encouraged to eat your chocolate insulin? It'll help you grow big and strong.
I'd say, you're a scam artist, sir, and get out of my bedroom.
Well, what if I told you that chocolate insulin also involved nanobots?
Get out of my brain. Well, if this wasn't an alternate week journal club, I would call you the first rank grade of snake oil salesman.
Okay, but what if I told you it was good enough for baboons?
Okay, now we're talking about preclinical data, and you've got a little bit of my attention going on. Proceed.
Now that I have your attention, let me see if I can pique your interest.
You are a persistent salesman, sir.
Yeah. So this is a study to develop a new way of taking insulin by eating a capsule or a piece of chocolate. Inside of this capsule, or very specifically designed chocolate, you'll find tiny nano carriers, which are 1/10,000th the width of a human hair, because as Americans, we like to just come up with arbitrary measurements and comparisons.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's kind of, you want to try to relate it to the real world as much as possible, right? Because anyone could take out a hair and be like, oh, that's thin, that's small. But the tough thing after that is saying, oh, divide that hair up into, you know, 1,000. Yeah, 1,000 slices, exactly. Or 10,000, you said?
1/10,000th.
1/10,000th, yeah. That's, yeah. Now it's outside of our imaginative capabilities.
Yeah, so. But this way of taking insulin orally is thought to be, it's more precise because it delivers insulin to the areas of the body that are actually using it. Now, when you take insulin, whether it's injected through a pump, it's an injection, and it's then spread through the body where it has the potential to cause unwanted side effects, the biggest one being hypoglycemia, or acute low blood sugar, something that drops it so low you feel dizzy, lightheaded, you're at risk for passing out.
Right.
So the big breakthrough here is that a coating was created that protects these insulin pills from being broken down by stomach acid, which would inactivate them, and it keeps it safe until it reaches the area where it's metabolized or actively supposed to be broken down, which is the liver. In the liver, there are enzymes, gluconidase, that can then break down this coating, which means this pill would only be active when blood glucose levels are high, and therefore only release the insulin when it can be used.
Ooh, okay. So, like an insulin pump in a pill?
Kind of, yeah. Okay. So you would, the idea being you would take this pill normally, and let's say you didn't eat a lot that day, then your blood sugar wouldn't rise, and the pill would just stay inactive because the liver would not produce the enzyme needed to activate it.
And you'd poop it out.
Right. Without that protective coating, you take an oral insulin pill, if you don't eat a certain amount, you're at risk for becoming hypo or low blood sugar, low glycemic. So this has already been tested on nematodes, on mice, rats, and now baboons in the National Baboon Colony in Australia. Not where I thought we were going to go with this, but we do have a lot of Australian listeners, so this one's for you, mates.
Yeah. Your accent, like, range is amazing. I love it so much. No, don't offend them. Oh my God, please don't turn us off. Yes. I actually love that they tested this, because they wanted to use a human-ish kind of a stomach to actually take a look at it. But they tested for pH responsiveness in, acidic environments, And they used a human duodenum explant. Is this the same?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is the same experiment, right? They did the duodenum explants, but for some reason they also decided to go through the non-parasitic worm C. elegans, Caenorhabdus elegans as well. I don't know. I'm guessing they did have to do a stepping stone before they, you know, gave these medications to baboons, because there is an ethics step there. But I don't know how you go duodenal explants to, you know, non-parasitic worm gut and then to baboon gut. But in case we needed to safely administer insulin to worms, we now can.
So we've solved the problem of diabetic worms for all you fans of Dune.
Fear is the little death. Sorry. So, but they've shown that this nanoparticle coupled together with insulin and stabilizing it this way, and then using that system as a release form to kind of activate the insulin, so to speak, when it's needed, has been proven in many different types of environments. This would be amazing in so many different ways. It would mean that a person, you know, of course, doesn't have to go through the painful thing of giving themselves a shot, but they also don't have to time it out. Because the way that this pill works, if it works the way that it does in principle, is that the hormone should release when you need it according to the signals that your body would naturally use to tell your pancreas to release insulin if your pancreas was capable of doing so.
The ultimate goal, of course, being to turn insulin into something as easy to take as a Flintstone vitamin.
Oh, yeah.
So 20 baboons took part in this study. In order to get the baboons to take the pill, as they are pickier than rats or nematodes,
sure,
they incorporated it into sugar-free chocolate. And when they received the medicine, their blood sugar was lowered, but no evidence of hypoglycemia was found. This is the point I want to keep harping on. Because yes, we could create oral insulin, but the point is that you have to be able to control when it's released. So trials on humans are going to start in 2025. In the first phase one trial, they're going to just investigate the safety of the insulin and look at hypoglycemia in healthy type 1 diabetic patients. If they can reproduce this lack of hypoglycemia that's been seen with the baboons, they'll know that it's safe. They can move on to how it can replace injections for people who are longstanding diabetics in phase two, with the goal being that this could be on the market as soon as 2 to 3 years. Now, a lot of things can happen in 2 or 3 years. So this is not a promise. This is not a threat. This is just the goal.
Yes. So this is, you have to lay this type of plan out when you're doing drug development ahead of time, not just for the sake of, you know, having a good understanding of where your research will go, but also in this day and age, finding the appropriate investors and this kind of thing. I love this solution. It is quite simple because the quantum dots that they're using to conjugate with the insulin in order to create this technology is just silver sulfide. They're really simple little molecules. And that also means that this could actually be used for other types of, you know, hormone therapy as needed for the future. So this could have implications past insulin if this were to work out. But it also, in theory, means that the delivery of this medication in terms of cost and everything else could be really, really friendly to the patient and to the doctor if, how do I put it, people are not assholes about it and don't artificially, you know, explode the price of this thing. So I'm very, very hopeful for it. I really am.
So you're telling me we need to keep the price low, and that would be sweet?
That would be very, very sweet. Yeah. I'm getting a little bit on my soapbox, but I do hope that when this all does come out, as promising and lovely as it is, that it's accessible to everybody on the planet.
Well, in order for that to happen, we are going to need to scale up our production of insulin somehow.
Oh, yeah.
Because right now, it's mostly used to grow it as a byproduct protein in these bacterial cultures. And before that, it was extracted from cow pancreases sourced from slaughterhouses.
Yes. You had to take out the pancreas after you killed your cow. You took the rest of the stuff away for meat, and then you took the pancreas and you processed out the insulin.
Fun fact, eating pancreas as an organ, often referred to as sweetmeats, for no clear reason. They're not particularly sweet.
They're not. No. Yeah.
But if we're trying to keep with my forced theme, that's an important fact to throw in.
I mean, shoehorn everything in, please.
So what if we could skip the step of slaughtering the cow and get them to produce the insulin for us directly?
Okay. Very, very nice. So what else do we get from cows?
What don't we get from cows, Santosh?
See, we get various stereotypes about Hindus, you know, calling the cow sacred for, you know, very, but they do, they provide freaking everything. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of milk.
So scientists used a modified virus that carried a specific cow milk protein promoter, which they then mixed with human insulin gene sequences to alter these cells. Uh-huh. Then they injected all of these altered protein and cow milk protein and human insulin combinations into several cow embryos. They implanted those embryos into pregnant cows. And one of those pregnant cows created this hybrid cow that can produce insulin in its milk. So they tried this with like 6 or 7 different clones or frozen embryos, and one took, and using a DNA construct specific to mammary tissue or breast tissue means there's no human insulin circulating in the cow's blood or other tissues. It's only being produced by the udder.
That's utterly amazing.
Holy cow, right?
Yeah. Oh, so many good cow puns.
So this takes advantage of the mammary gland's capabilities for producing large quantities of protein. So this modified cow, as it grew to adolescence and reproductive age, produced in its milk proinsulin, which interestingly also converted some of this precursor into the directly active insulin. But it was only showing up in the milk, not its blood. So you could still, in theory, use this single lone insulin-producing cow for meat. Wouldn't advise it, because then we're out our insulin cow.
Yeah.
But using conservative estimates, if this could be reproduced, that means a single cow could produce about 1 gram of insulin per liter of milk once you extract it, which is a lot more than you're getting out of bacterial culture plates.
Gotcha. Okay. Very, very nice. This is, well, I mean, not to milk the point.
No, but, milk it. Milk it.
I mean, you know, a little too much of this and we might end up getting intolerant, but that's okay.
I don't mean to steer the conversation. but this is no bull.
No, I think we can get through this point and then hoof it off to another subject. But I would love to come back around to Spider Goat, because this is a little bit like the gene experiments that were done to produce the silk proteins, which were spliced with goats, with mama goats, so that the silk would come out in large amounts in their udders. And I know for a fact that, Josh, you and I milked that particular point, you know, up and down this fine country of ours at our live events.
So now now that we've talked about Spider Goat at our live events, we can also bring up Wonka Cow.
Wonka Cow? What? are we?
That's my name. That's my name. No scientists have jumped on that yet.
Are we going to start enslaving cows, or what's going on?
Oompa Loompa, doopa dee doo. This cow has got insulin for you.
I mean, I would have thought like all domesticated cows are Wonka cows already.
So a single cow could produce about 1 gram of insulin per liter. The typical Holstein cow makes 40 to 50 liters per day.
Yes. Whoa.
1 gram of insulin is about 28,000 units of insulin. So a single cow could supply thousands of diabetic patients with their daily insulin for an entire month. And that's from just 1 liter. So you could have your meat cows, your dairy cows, and your sugar cows, your Wonka cows, all in different pens. This creates a new revenue stream, I guess.
Wow.
And there you go. If they can scale this up, you no longer have problem. The price of insulin would drop, and then you can get all this mass-produced cow milk insulin into these nanoparticles, our sugar-free chocolate pills. And there we go. We've eliminated injection as a means of treating this almost entirely.
I love kind of seeing this in real time. I don't know if anything is going to come of all of this, but there are moments in science history that come up like this, which are, they're absolutely tremendous. There's a confluence of ideas and technology, which kind of hits this critical mass as it comes together. And you end up with this beautiful little quantum leap forward where, you know, the practices of a bygone era are just absolutely evaporated in the course of like 3 to 4 years. Because, you know, for the longest time, there was no solution for diabetes. In our little kids with type 1 diabetes, you basically just had to starve them, because giving them any kind of food meant that you'd be flooding their bodies with sugar and they'd sooner or later just go into a coma and die. So you just had to kind of keep their calories ultra, ultra low. And then you had injections, which were painful, and then they got better and we had insulin pumps. But now you've got this really cool combo of material science and gene technology, and boom, you go like, you know, insulin cow chocolate pill.
that's not from brown cows, because they don't make chocolate milk.
No, they do not. Unfortunately, that's on the horizon. I'm 100% sure.
So again, right now, only a single cow exists that can do this. So you have to really scale up production, make sure that you have the health and welfare of these transgenic cows and get regulatory approvals from the dairy industry, from the FDA. These are all huge challenges. This is not going to be happening anytime soon, but it is possible. And that's the exciting thing.
I really do love it. Do you remember, Josh, when we had that wonderful conversation about the super secret eggs?
Oh, yes. That, government. Yeah, yeah. Government protected eggs.
Government protected eggs. I have no doubt, because these cows will be making an essential medical product, that we're going to have super secret government cows.
Old McDonald had a highly classified farm. EIEI, get off my property.
No. Yeah. EIEI, you are now on restricted turnaround.
Yeah. So let's move on to our last story. So remember how in the beginning of the episode we scared you with microplastics?
Sure.
Well, let's take away a little bit of that fear.
Yeah.
According to a study published in Environmental Science and Technology, you can boil water to remove microplastics. Now, I want to be let's talk about this in a little bit more detail.
Sure.
So the abstract itself suggests that you can boil hard water, and we'll talk about the difference between hard and soft water. You can boil hard water for 2 to 5 minutes and then filter it, and that removes up to 90% of microplastics from water.
So here's the difficulty. One of the things about the nano and microplastics. So nanoplastics, by the way, smaller than 1 micron, which is a millionth of a meter, if I'm remembering properly.
But how many human hairs is that?
And stop it. Microplastics are between 1 to 5,000 microns. So they're you know, a larger class of particle. Pretty much all the same. These are, you know, massive hydrocarbons. The thing about them, Josh, though, is they don't break down. Like sunlight, heat, you can't really grind them down any further. They're chemically inert, so they don't react with acids or bases to break down any further. So like boiling, if you're talking about getting rid of them, boiling shouldn't do anything, right?
Well, yes and no. So the study found boiling hard water for 2 to 5 minutes and then filtering it, and this is what we're going to get into, removes up to 90% of microplastics from hard water, only about 25% from soft water. So we'll talk about that. Hold that thought.
Okay, gotcha.
When water is boiled, it creates calcium carbonate, which can form a little bit of a chalky crust in your tea kettle, your pots. This calcium carbonate crust can trap plastic particles.
Oh, got it. So this is what those of us who drink tea and we have an electric kettle or even a stovetop kettle, it's called a scale. It like lines the inside of your teapot after you take the water out.
So when you increase the water's temperature, this calcium carbonate precipitates out of the water, forming a great word, your word for today, incrustant.
I'd never heard of incrustant before. I am pretty sure that is a novel science word.
Or little crystals, if you want to be technical about it.
Yeah.
But these incrustants become solid particles that wrap and clump around the microplastics, which make those microplastics a lot larger or big enough to filter out.
Oh, okay. All right. So if the microplastics are floating around there along with minerals, you do your boiling, your crusty stuff, you know, does what it usually does. It forms a scale either at the bottom or the sides of your kettle, but the micro particle plastics, they're actually trapped in that lattice, in the crystallization.
And that's that little film. But you really are only getting calcium carbonate in hard water, mineral heavy water.
So all those folks, including myself with a water softener, no worky.
Well, that's why you only remove about 25%, because there's just not as much calcium carbonate in soft water as hard. So this is really some, and again, I want to emphasize, boiling the water is not a sufficient step by itself. You then have to filter it. So,
got it.
And we talked briefly about this on our last episode, So Is Your Face, where you have to filter out water that you're putting in your neti pots. Just boil your water, people, wherever you're getting it from. Boil and filter your water.
And it doesn't have to be for very long. For those people with electric kettles, depending on, you know, what type of volt architecture that you live in, it takes anywhere from 2 to 4 minutes to bring your water to a boil. Yeah.
So even if you have soft water, this is worth doing, although you're not getting as much of that beneficial effect. And again, this is not an end-all be-all solution, because you are still getting microplastics from eating food in plastic containers, from other sources that we're uneven aware of. But at least the the microplastics from your water, you can now do something about. So how do you know if you have hard water or soft water?
Well, there's a couple of ways that you can do it. My favorite way here in the United States is if you go to wash your hands and you put soap and soap up your hands and then wash it with water. If you have soft water, because there's no mineral content, you will still end up to where your hands feel a little bit soapy and filmy, even though there's no more soap on it, because the surfactant effect from the soap has gone on there. You've washed off the soap, but there's no minerals, you know, like the calcium and the sodium in there to actually like kind of scrub and create that post soap feeling. So it still feels a bit slimy. So I like soft water, but it can sometimes feel a little bit weird.
Now, another way to tell is look in your sink or dishwasher or wherever you keep your glassware after being washed. And if you notice there's a lot of spots on the glassware or some stains on surfaces or mineral buildup, such as an increase in residue around your faucet that's white or greenish. So if you have kind of that little film that builds up around your faucet, that can be a sign of hard water.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So that is another easier way to do it.
So if you are going to try and decrease the microplastics in your drinking, boil the water and then install a filter either on your tap, so you filter to start with, or put it into a water filter dispenser after you've boiled it, like a Brita filter.
Yeah. And in fact, it doesn't need to be, I don't believe this needs to be like a super duper, like ultra filtration type of filter, right? You basically just have to get out things that are, fairly large chunks of, these crystals. So you don't have to have one of those like micro nano filter thingies.
And that's how you can keep your microplastics low, which I think is pretty darn sweet. There we go. Shoehorned it in with every story. So that's it for this week. As always, we love your comments, questions, and feedback, as well as episode ideas. If you'd like to contribute those or support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links for further reading. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. The show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. And until next time, as always, keep a song in your heart, soap on your hands, a shot in your arm, a spin on your globe, easy access to cows, or decrease a filter on your boiled water. I don't know. I got nothing for this. Just boil your water and watch
put
your
it
sugar.
Through a filter. Watch your sugar. Exercise, right? For those of you who are not insulin-dependent diabetics right now, exercise. Watch your diet so that you don't become insulin.
And when you've done all those things, spin a globe, pick a country that has, I don't know, maybe secret government farms. And after that, happy travels.
Bye, everybody.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.